This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Women are the foundation of many black churches. They keep the books, raise the funds, and educate the congregation's children. And women make up more than 85% of most black church congregations. But the leadership of those churches is often male-dominated. And when we see women of the church in the media, they're often preachers' wives or assistants.
God made the man the head. God created us to be a help, suitable, fitted to help the man. I love that, because I always say, God knew me and needed help, and well, he knew, and he made us.
We get a clip from the Oxygen reality show, Preachers of L.A. Ebony Marshall Turman explores the power and struggle of black women in the church. She's the author of a new book, Toward a Womanist Ethic of Incarnation. Ebony Marshall Turman is the director of the Black Church Studies Program at Duke Divinity School, and she joins us now on The State of Things. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Tell us about this. This is a fascinating statistic, the power and the importance of women in black churches, and yet the sort of the lack of leadership positions.
Yeah.
And this is something, obviously, that you think about. What explains this, do you think?
Well, clearly, it is a matter of patriarchy that is normative in our society, not just in our churches. It is something, of course, that is not organic to African-American churches as they are conceived out of the invisible institution. And yet it is something that is upheld in not all, but most of them. Sexism in black churches is rampant. It is seen, as you've already stated, in the fact that the churches are they are comprised of black women disproportionately, and yet our leadership does not reflect the bodies that are in the pews. And so it is simply a matter of patriarchy and its presence in African-American churches.
Tell us more about the roles that black women do play in those churches.
Oh, they do all kinds of things in the church. And let me say that there are many black women who do serve as religious leaders, but disproportionately so. Black women, as has already been stated, are teachers in the church, teaching children and adults. Black women are preachers from the floor, exhorting the congregation from spaces beyond the pulpit. They are ministry leaders, leading and really bringing substance to the actual service that the church provides, not only to those inside its walls, but to the community at large. Black women, you know, they are tithing to churches, giving their offerings, and supporting really the lifestyle of preachers and the religious leadership as well. And because their numbers are so high, this is really the money of black women that is actually undergirding the sacralization or the making sacred of sexism and gender discrimination.
You have actually had personal experience with this. You were actually at the Abyssinian Church in Harlem preaching, and you've had kind of first-hand experience with this kind of two-tiered system. Tell us.
Absolutely. So I was the youngest woman to be ordained by the Abyssinian Baptist Church, the second woman to preside over the ordinances in its 206-year history. And so I very much so had the experience of seeing how women have functioned to sustain the church over the years, even insofar as forming the church, you know, founding the church itself, and yet being marginalized as it pertains to their leadership in the church. One of the examples that I can give from my time serving at Abyssinian, but an example that would not be specific to Abyssinian, again, this is something that we see in all kinds of churches, is the reality that women cannot be ordained as deacons, right? So as those persons who are serving the Lord's table and the pastor's table and the table of the sick and poor, able to serve communion to those who are sick and shut in, able to preside over or support in the work of baptism, in the real work of spiritual renewal that the church is engaged in. And yet, these are the women who are discipling children, who are raising up the next generation of witnesses, the next generation of even those men and who will, you know, given what history has told us, be the ones to lord it over them in the days ahead. So, yeah, I've been up close and personal.
Well, and as you said, the Abyssinian Baptist Church is not alone in this, but mm-hmm. it is an object lesson in the paradox mm. because that is a church that is synonymous with and so important to the civil rights movement for African Americans.
Certainly.
And then here we have this kind of two-tiered system. And a church which had such enormous support in education and fundraising, all of those things that allowed for a Martin Luther King and a SCLC to actually bring forward the flower of that movement in the decades that preceded it. So it is a real paradox and an irony.
It certainly is. And I deal with this paradox in my book at length, this idea that the black church was actually born as in resistance to body injustice. Right. So in resistance to the racism that was at the core, along with the economic racism, perhaps, of American slavocracy. The black church was born in this context of black suffering based on bodies that defied the arbiters of power, their understanding of what a body should be. And so for a church to be rooted in this sort of prophetic tradition that resists body injustice, to then participate in reproducing body injustice, not so much on the color line, but as it relates to gender and specifically black women, is a paradox at its best, right? I mean, it is the epitome of paradoxical behavior, which is made sacred, right, in the name of the Father.
How much, though, did the origins, and you talked about the forces that forged this church, we're talking about an institution that had to be met with a kind of resistance. The church becomes the most powerful institution. How much did those forces actually contribute to what we now call a paradox? The need for men, a safe place for men to embody their masculinity in an environment that otherwise refused to recognize it.
Certainly. And I recognize that what's happening in black churches in terms of the reproduction of oppression as it relates to black women is merely a function of a sort of a domination or supremacy that is coded in blackface. It is within the context of American slavocracy, the space wherein the black church was born as the invisible institution, this single sex paradigm, which is at the heart of patriarchy, a single sex paradigm that suggests only men can do certain things, can hold certain kinds of power, was not organic to the black experience, particularly because within enslavement, black men and black women were equals insofar as they were both shed of all manner of agency and power. And therefore, this single-sex system is just not organic to who we are as people. And within a slave religion, within the black church itself, it never existed. Right. This patriarchal norm. Black women and black men work together in the work of religious expression. It's not until the black church becomes institutionalized, that is, where it is actually dismissed and becomes real concrete buildings, brick and mortar unto itself, that we see the reproduction of gender discrimination in black churches as it seeks to live into a respectability politics that is foreign to its very heart and soul.
Is that respectability politics perhaps the answer to the question, why was this institution the answer? Why was this the institution of resistance over and against the system? Because there are options.
Certainly. I'm not so sure that there were many options, however, at that time, at the real emergence of black religion within American slavery. But and so I wouldn't go that far to say that there could have been another way in terms of the church. I think black people, because of the suffering that was experienced through their coming here, being brought here to the Americas, that God was in many ways their only hope, mm-hmm. And continues to be as black persons of African descent continue to face all manner of disproportionate marginalization. But how we understand God and how we have oriented ourselves to God has been deeply problematic, and we need to change it.
You talk, and I think you answered that a little bit earlier as well, and you do in the book by saying that before it was institutionalized, before it was brick and mortar, it was far more egalitarian and far less patriarchal. And
absolutely.
So there was an evolution that didn't begin looking like the church that we see now. Let's talk more about that prophetic mission, that mm-hmm. voice over and against the dominant narrative, mm-hmm. A voice of God that is a voice of hope but also a voice of aspiration. What role does that play now in the church?
Well, it seems that, especially with shows like Preachers of L.A. and Preacher's Daughters and others, that that voice has been silenced. Certainly, as it relates to popular culture and what is most titillating for the media, these are the images that have been put forth and would make us believe that the black church, there is no more hope for it. However, the reality is that the prophetic tradition still very much exists within the black church, and black churches are on the front line as it relates to social injustices, especially against people of African descent, but otherwise as well. The problem is that whereas the black church is very quick to come to support matters of race and racialization, the black church is slow and continues to be slow as it relates to the intersection of race and gender for black women specifically, as well as slow to respond to the matters of sexual injustice for our brothers and sisters who are sexual minorities. And so we need to make a whole case for justice and not a partial case for justice, which is what my work is about.
You draw parallels between, speaking of this prophetic voice, mm-hmm. the black church has stood as an indictment and a voice over and against the dominant narrative of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
But as you suggest, not as powerful. Is that prophetic voice rising? You say in the book you draw parallels between Jesus and
mm-hmm.
black women.
Mm-hmm.
Talk more about that.
Sure. Well, what I say in the book is essentially that Jesus' body defied what a normative body was supposed to be. And we look to the Council of Chalcedon in a very particular way, as well as to Jesus, the historical Jesus, to understand why that is the case.
Tell us about that council and what happened.
So the Council of Chalcedon, as it was concretized in 451, essentially claimed that Jesus was both divine and human. But making this claim for Jesus a simultaneous divinity and humanity was radical, because up until then, the church had been fighting about whether Jesus was divine or whether Jesus was human, one or the other. To claim that Jesus is a both and Jesus was to, you know, to present a body that did not, you know, did not correspond with what we thought or what these communities, these religious communities thought a body was supposed to be. And so we see in Jesus as presented at Chalcedon that bodies that defy how we understand normativity actually have redemptive possibilities. That's a baseline argument. You really have to read the book to understand the fullness of that. But I translate that to say that black women's bodies especially, also defy what we understand normative embodiment to be. On the one hand, they are black, right? And blackness within the context of America has typically been related to dishonorability and even, historical narrative tells us, bestiality. On the other hand, black women are women. All at the same time. And womanhood has typically been seen as secondary to manhood, right? So we get both of these spaces where black women just are almost less than human, right? Living in the intersection of blackness and womanness. And so I suggest that Jesus is in fact a black woman, or consubstantial with black women as to his ethical identity, because he too, right, was navigating these two spaces that did not make sense, right, to the world around him, right, as we understand the historical Jesus, and even as Jesus is brought to us through the Chalcedonian definition. And yet in Jesus, that is where the redemption for the church was.
But the both and, which mm-hmm. you explore in the book, and you have a background as a dancer, mm-hmm. and I wonder how big a role that played in your understanding of these ideas.
Well, I think my role as a dancer is what drew me to the body, period, right? To an interest in body, to an interest in how bodies are read, how bodies perform in certain kinds of spaces, and how bodies are acted upon unjustly. I had an experience once when I was dancing of dancing with a group of African American dancers, and all of our funders were non-African American, and we had to line up and say our names. This is within the context of the new millennium, and it was just very interesting for me. I remember that moment very clearly about how my body was performing in that space, how my body was being translated, how it was being read. And so that interest in the body certainly emerges from my work as an artist and also my deep love for the Black church.
I have very little time left. Do you think things are changing in the Black church?
I absolutely do. I believe that things are changing slowly but surely. There are more African-American women in seminary becoming theologically trained than ever before. There are more women preaching in churches and holding leadership positions in churches, pastoral leadership positions in churches than ever before. And although it is slow going, change is going to come.
I want to thank you very much. Pleasure talking with you, Ebony.
The pleasure's all mine.
Ebony Marshall Turman is director of Black Church Studies at Duke Divinity School and the author of Toward a Womanist Ethic of Incarnation. She's going to give a talk at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church in Charlotte this Sunday, March 9th. And you can go to our website for more information about that. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Mataferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf is our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.